So let's begin our first lecture in the new year. And this first lecture opens the cycle of two lectures that we will spend on this course discussing the issues related to performance evaluation. So today we're going to look at the science behind performance evaluation. Next week, we're going to look at the practice of performance evaluation. So we're going to see how the scientific principles of performance evaluation are reflected in the managerial practices of performance evaluation. So, but first, a bit of theory, hence the topic of today's lecture. Now, performance evaluation is a necessary activity in the majority of organizations. I would say even in every organization, especially the organizations that practice incentive pay or other ways of motivating people based on their performance. If you want to motivate people and reward them based on their performance, you have to measure this performance, right? The way you measure people's performance is how you do performance evaluation. So hence the importance of performance evaluation. The first item on the potentially long list of why performance evaluation is necessary and important is that performance evaluation is necessary to support the activities and practices of incentive compensation. And we've studied a lot of practices of incentive compensations in the past. So, but just to add some humor to the otherwise dry lecture of today, I invite you to read this short piece of text, which is a sort of stylized report that line managers often write about the people who report to them, right? And as you can see, this, if you read this text entirely, you'll see that Joe Smith seems to be one of the best employees in that department, you know. Can be found working hard in his cubicle. Joe never thinks twice about assisting his colleagues. So always finishes given assignments on time. Works hard, often skipping coffee breaks. No vanity in spite of his high accomplishments. Nearly a saint. But then, if you read only through the odd numbered lines, you'll see a completely different picture. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like a riddle. Yeah. So this of course stylized and not really realistic performance evaluation report is there to highlight the trickiness of the business of performance evaluation. So The performance evaluation is a tricky business because there are a lot of facets in which employee performance demonstrates itself and can therefore be evaluated. The task of performance evaluation is to get the most reliable and objective signal from the various manifestations of employee performance. And based on this signal, to make a variety of decisions, starting with compensation, proceeding to promotions, proceeding to identifying training needs, or if need be, the decision to terminate employment. Sometimes it's also the case. So here's another more realistic example of performance evaluation. This is my performance evaluation when I was a professor at Goethe University, Frankfurt. I was teaching a course, Foundations of Organizational Economics, and this was one of the top five, certainly, courses in the Fachbereich, sometimes even one of the top three courses. And, you know, here's my average, here's the performance evaluation that I got for this course, 5.17 out of 6, and this was way above the average, as you can see, along the many dimensions of performance. It's a multi-dimensional performance evaluation. I teach exactly the same course here in Konstanz. My evaluation is 2.8, and it's well below the average for the department. Now, try understanding this. And if you can get some idea, let me know. So why evaluate performance? By the way, thanks for evaluating my performance in the middle of December or early December. I don't remember exactly when. The grade you gave me was 2, which was very close to the average of the faculty of law, economics, and politics. So I'm just the average guy here. Actually below average if you take all the courses that I teach. So performance evaluation is a tricky business. I still believe my lectures are great, even though it's not necessarily reflected in performance evaluations. Now, so why do you evaluate performance? The main reason why you evaluate performance is to support the practices of performance pay, right? Incentives are the essence of economics. Incentives are practiced in organizations all the time, monetary, non-monetary, promotions, demotions. So in order to support the complicated and strategically important system of performance incentive compensation, you need to have performance evaluation. So that's the most important reason. But there's more to it, right? Performance evaluation is interesting on its own, not only as a supporting infrastructure for incentive compensation. One reason why performance evaluation is interesting and important on its own, why it can be used as a managerial tool on its own, is to signal to the workers what this organization is about, is to communicate the values of the organization in a salient way. Right? What is it? What aspects of your performance are appreciated, and to what extent? Right? So some people may not realize what exactly are the aspects of their performance that are more important. Now, if you have the performance evaluation practice, you will see exactly what aspects of your performance are important. If a certain aspect of your performance is not important, then it won't be on the evaluation form. So performance evaluation also serves to emphasize the values and aspects of performance that organizational management regards as important. To recognize and promote talent in organizations, right? We looked at we had a lecture on probations and promotions. We had some thoughts about the advantages and disadvantages of internal labor market. Now, one thing that is characteristic of the internal labor market is internal promotions. You have different levels of hierarchy. You have junior jobs, you have senior jobs. People are sometimes hired from the outside into senior jobs, but as the jobs get more and more senior, more and more people tend to be promoted to these jobs rather than hired into them internally. Now, to facilitate the promotion process, you need performance evaluation. You also need performance evaluation to identify training needs and personal improvements, right? So, yes, I think my lectures are great, but students don't like my lectures, so I see exactly what they like more, what they like less, and if I care, I can actually try to identify training needs and get some training done to that end. So training needs identification is part of the reason why performance evaluation is done. Now, another interesting reason, and we'll talk a lot more about it in the second part of the personnel economics course in the summer semester, so stay tuned if you're interested. Another reason why performance evaluation is important is it's a vehicle of providing personalized feedback, the individual feedback to employees on their relative performance. So the provision of feedback, as it turns out, is quite important. And we will talk, as I said, we'll talk a lot more about the importance of providing individual feedback in the second half of this course. Suffice it to say that some people even think that the very act of providing feedback may result in performance consequences which are comparable with the performance effect of monetary incentives, right? So how do you provide feedback? How do you provide feedback? You could say, well done, Nick, right? Or you could say you could communicate well done, Nick, or badly done, Nick, to Nick in private, right, in order to save the embarrassment and to comply with the regulations. So you can actually what organizations do very often is that they communicate negative feedback privately. So you get your layoff notice as a personal mail, personal letter, which no one is supposed to open. But if they want to give you the lecturer of the year title, they typically celebrate it in front of the many colleagues and students who care to turn up. And that makes sense, not only from the compliance and ethics point of view, but also it makes sense from the economics point of view. People value feedback irrespective of training needs, irrespective of wanting to learn about the values that organizations care about. People value feedback because one of the higher level needs in the Maslow hierarchy of needs, if you care to remember this little thing, is the need for belonging and association. And how do you cultivate this feeling of belonging and association? You want to see how well you fit to the group of individuals or an organization in which you want to belong and associate with. And evaluation is one of the ways to communicate this feedback to you, based on which you can assess the degree to which you fit or belong to an organization. So there are many ways in which performance evaluation is used, but for the purposes of this lecture, we will confine ourselves to studying the role of performance evaluation in facilitating compensation schemes. So we will concentrate on the most important reason why performance evaluation is used, namely to support incentive compensation. Now, as I said, there are many aspects of employee performance that one can observe. Performance effort is not observable. That's a problem. That has interesting implications with regards to the design of incentive compensation schemes. Typically, you lose efficiency when you can't observe effort unless you are risk neutral, which is a bit unrealistic, as you may have learned from the previous lecture given by Dr. Rupieta. But how exactly should you organize the monitoring and recording of the various aspects of various manifestations of employee performance? What aspects of employee performance are good measures of performance? So these are the questions that we're going to try and address. And in the science of management, not the art of management, not the, you know, charisma and leadership part of the management science, management discourse, but in the mathematical science of precisely how you should organize operational procedures supporting incentive compensation, the following four scientific principles of performance evaluation are identified. So we're going to talk about each of them in the rest of the lecture. So what defines a good measure of agent's performance, a good measure of employee performance, has to conform to the following four principles of performance evaluation. First, the so-called monitoring intensity principle. What it says? It says that the measure of agent's performance, the measure of agent's performance should be as precise as economically reasonable. So effort can't be observed. You can observe output, which is a function of effort. Now, output is not a precise one-to-one measure of effort because there's noise, right? So you can have very loose measure of output with lots of noise relative to the effort. You can have very precise measure of output with relatively little noise and a lot more powerful effort signal in it. Of course, it costs you more resources, it's more expensive to get more precise measures of output, so at some point you have to hit the trade-off between the benefits of more precise performance measurement and the costs of more precise performance measurement. And this is the optimal intensity of monitoring, the optimal degree of precision that you should plan in your performance evaluation techniques. Hence the title. We will study the mathematics of it in just a few minutes. Now, the next principle of performance evaluation to which a good performance measure must conform is the so-called informativeness principle. Informativeness principle, an answer to the exam that will give you maybe half of the point to this question, but not more, is that a measure of performance should be informative. It will give you up to half of the point, depending on how good your handwriting is, because it's tautology, right? Informativeness principle tells is rather that a performance evaluation practice should use all the economically available information about effort. What it says is that if there are lots of measures which are informative of effort, you should incorporate all of them into your performance assessment exercise rather than concentrate on a particular one or two. Now, the next is equal compensation principle, which is relatively easy. What it says is that each aspect of performance, each activity that agent carries out, must be rewarded in proportion to the gain that it gives to the principal. So there are some activities that are much more important, there are some activities that are not so important. The relatively important activities have to be rewarded more and have to be evaluated more precisely than the activities that are relatively unimportant. Right? So it is important for a professor to publish scientific papers and win research grants. There are some incentives incorporated into employment contracts to motivate these actions. Teaching evaluations are not the most important performance indicator. So yes, there are some rewards for excellent teaching evaluations, but they're not as sharp as rewards for excellent papers or research funds. Now, the last but not least is the so-called alignment principle. This is slightly sort of more difficult to understand, but nevertheless very intuitive. So the intuition behind the alignment principle is that you don't always have the performance measure that is best. What you do have is a combination of performance measures that are less ideal, that are correlated with what you really want to achieve, but is not really what you want to achieve. For instance, every organization wants to achieve a long-term financial viability, right? What is long-term financial viability? You can measure it with profits, you can measure it with returns on assets, you can measure it with share of the market, etc. None of these measures are really fully 100% long-term financial viability, whatever it means, right? You measure this abstract term with some accounting artifacts, with some ratios and coefficients and what have you. They are important, they are interesting, but they are not long-term financial viability. So you always or very often use proxies, proxy outcomes to approximate the performance outcome that organization is really interesting in. So the alignment principle says that the proxies for performance should be influenced by agent's effort in the same way as the real thing, as the real performance outcome. So you should not reward bad proxies of performance, and you should not reward the proxies of performance that are positively influenced by agent's effort but negatively correlated with the performance outcome that your organization wants to achieve. Much more on this later on in the lecture. So let's look at the mathematics of the monitoring intensity principle. And as a starting point, I invite you to go back to slide 133, I think, where we derived this formula. This is the optimal piece rate in the linear incentive contract for a risk averse agent, right? So this is the optimal strength of incentives, beta, which depends positively on the marginal product of effort and depends negatively on the noise of performance measure. This is going to be the key parameter in our discussion right now. And it also negatively depends on the risk aversion parameter, which is not so important for the purposes of today's lecture, but it's still there. Okay, so what do you want to achieve by offering incentives? You want the workers to work. Do you want the worker to work as hard as possible? Well, not necessarily, you know. You want the worker to exert the level of effort which is as close as possible to the efficient level of effort. Now, what is the efficient level of effort? The efficient level of effort is the level of effort at which maximizes the total efficiency, which is basically the difference between the output and the costs of effort. Now, if you have one other thing that you should have learned from the last lecture is that when agents are risk averse, the efficient level of effort is not achieved. Why is it not achieved? Because the optimal strength of incentives is below the efficient strength of incentives. The efficient strength of incentives, remember, should be equal to 1, right? So the in the fully efficient case, in the linear incentive contract, the agent should be given the entire output and he should pay the rent to the principal for the privilege. But it doesn't happen very often. Why does it not happen very often? Because of limited liability constraint and also because agents are risk averse, which means that the optimal strength of incentives is below 1, and that makes it less, that makes incentives less strong than the efficiency case and the effort under these incentives therefore being lower than the efficient effort. So it makes sense. It may make sense to strengthen incentives so that people will work harder and their effort level will be closer to the efficient effort level. But how can you achieve this, right? Let's look at this expression and see what we can manipulate with, right? And there isn't much we can really manipulate with. This is the production technology, which is given, right? The marginal product of effort is determined by technology. You can't do anything about it. I mean, you can change technology, sure, but let's assume you can't change technology. There is a technology that you have to deal with. Okay, now, what else it depends on? Depends on the costs of effort. You can't change the costs of effort, right? For a given individual, the cost of effort is a reflection of the skills, abilities, and attitudes of this particular individual, which are very, very hard, if not impossible, to change. Sure, you can try to hire people with lower costs of effort, but if you're stuck with your current employees, if you have to abide by the Kündigungsschutzgesetz, then you can't do much, right? You remember this from the tutorials, I guess. You have to make do with the technology and the people that you have right now, which means that you can't change these guys. You're stuck with them, right? So, nor can you change risk aversion unless you hire someone else. So the only thing that you're left to play with, the only thing that you could try to change is the sigma squared. What is the sigma squared? Just to remind you, the sigma squared is the variance of the noise eta in the performance measure Z that you have, right? And you can have a performance measure which is more noisy, which means that the variance of this eta is going to be greater. It's cheap. It's not difficult to measure, but it's going to be very, very noisy. Or and if this performance measure is noisy, if sigma squared is very large, then what you're going to have is, if you want to base incentives on this lousy, noisy measure of performance, the optimal incentives that you can possibly base on this measure of performance without hurting yourself is going to be very low. So incentives based on noisy performance measure are going to be very weak. Okay? So if the incentives based on the lousy, noisy performance measure are very weak, you're not going to make a lot of profit because workers are not going to work very hard, right? So you want workers to work a bit harder because you want to earn a bit of extra money. So what you can do is you can try to reduce the sigma squared. How can you try and reduce the sigma squared? By using a performance measure that is more precise, right? So lower sigma squared means more precise performance measure. If you use more precise performance measure, then the optimal strength of incentives that is consistent with this, that is based with this measure, is going to be higher, which means people will work harder, you will make more profit. So you are always interested in measuring, in trying to measure performance as precisely as you can. However, performance measurement is not cheap. Performance measurement is not cheap. If you want to measure my teaching performance, one way of doing so is to distribute paper questionnaires to students. They will give their evaluations. This performance measure is extremely noisy. I teach the same course in two universities. I get vastly different performance evaluation results. I even teach it in different years. I may get vastly different performance evaluation results, especially if the students who come to my lectures are few, because I let my lectures be video recorded. So you could tell a lot of stories about how noisy student performance evaluations are. I'm just giving you a couple of examples. So suppose you want to measure teaching performance more precisely. You would then send a trained educational specialist, a trained teacher, a trained Wirtschaftspädagoge, perhaps, to attend my lectures and make notes and write a report identifying the strengths and weaknesses of my teaching. But that will give a more precise measure of my teaching performance, but it's going to be more costly because you have to hire this specialist and pay them for their time and effort. So the point I want to make with these examples is that there is an element of costs which we so far have not considered in our calculations, and these are the costs of measuring performance, the big M function. And the costs of measuring performance is a function which depends on the degree of precision with which you want to measure performance. If you don't care about precision, if you're okay with high sigma squared, M is going to be high. It's going to be low. It's cheap performance measure. But if you really do care about precision, and if you want low sigma squared, then you're going to have to pay quite a lot of money for achieving this degree of precision. So what it means mathematically, it means that the costs of performance measurement function, cost of performance measurement as a function of precision of performance measurement, is monotonically decreasing with sigma squared and is convex with respect to sigma squared, so that its first derivative is negative. Higher value of sigma squared means cheaper performance measurement, and it's also convex in a, it's concave in the sense that if you want more and more and more precise measure of performance, you have to pay increasingly more for more precise measures of performance. If you want to reduce the variance by 10%, you have to pay, let's say, 20% more of the measurement costs. But if you want to reduce it by a further 10%, you'd have to pay maybe 50% more of the measurement costs. So that's what this result is telling you, right? So if performance measurement is costly, then what's going to happen is at some level of sigma squared, the benefits of performance measure in terms of stimulating effort will equate with the costs of performance measurement in terms of the additional extra marginal cost of measuring more precise performance. Right? So the monitoring intensity principle basically says that there's a trade-off between the benefits of precise performance measure and the costs of precise performance measurement. And it has some interesting implications, which we'll illustrate right now. So let's write down the principles profit function. The way we knew it before this lecture was, well, this is the output of the agent, this is the cost of effort of the agent, and this is the risk premium that you have to give to the agent to keep the agent under participation constraint. What we are discovering today is that there's another element in the prophet that needs to be taken into account, even in the efficiency case, because the costs of performance measurement are there, no matter what. The costs of performance measurement are not going to matter only for the risk-neutral agent, but we are in the world of risk-averse agent, right? R is not equal to zero, so we have to take uncertainty into account. Now, the question now is, according to the monitoring intensity principle, what is the optimal precision with which the principal will want to measure the performance of the agent? To answer this question, we have to maximize this profit with respect to sigma squared, because that's what we want to choose, right? So if you take a derivative of this profit function with respect to precision, you will get this expression. Now, let's look at it. This m prime is negative, so minus something negative gives you positive, okay? This term, minus half r times beta squared, is obviously negative for the risk-averse agent, and that's the empirically most interesting case. What does this mean, right? It means that if you want to get stronger incentives, if you're interested in high beta, if you really want to super-incentivize your agent, you have to make sure that your costs, that the precision with which you measure their performance is high enough for this equation to satisfy. Now, so this is an expression which contains beta and which contains sigma. Now, notice that you can choose both beta and sigma. And in fact, the most interesting implication of the monitoring intensity principle is that the problem of choosing the optimal incentives is only part of a broader and more interesting problem of choosing optimal incentives and optimal precision, optimal degree of precision of performance measurement. Firms don't just choose optimal incentives given their performance measurement technology. Actually, what happens is firms choose both. They choose both the precision with which they want to measure the performance and the optimal strength of incentives together. So it's a two-variable optimization problem rather than a one-variable optimization problem as we knew it before. So you choose beta from here and you choose sigma squared from here. These two equations, this is the optimal incentive strength and the first order condition from the profit maximization with respect to precision of performance measurement, these two equations hold simultaneously, and these are the equations in terms of beta and in terms of sigma. If you solve these equations together, you will get the optimal beta and the optimal sigma, which will be the pair of strength of incentives and optimal degree of performance measurement. Now, as a homework, you could do two things as a sort of interesting practice for the exam. You could do two things. One thing you see on the slides, show that the both beta and sigma square increase with the productivity of the agent. That's one thing you could do. Another thing you could do is to show that the welfare gain, that the profit gain from solving the optimization problem in terms of two variables, that is a simultaneous choice of strength of incentives and the precision of performance measure, will always give you a higher profit to the principal than choosing the optimal beta given the fixed and unchangeable precision of performance measurement. So you are always going to get more money if you can choose the degree of precision of your performance measurement compared to the case when you're stuck with a given level of precision of performance measurement, which has a number of implications for management practice, which I don't think I will have time to talk about at length, just to sort of signpost them and try to encourage further interest in these issues. Well, let's start with the more trivial implications. If you want to incentivize people strongly, you have to measure their performance more precisely. That's trivial, right? But who do you want to incentivize more strongly? You want to incentivize more strongly the people who are more productive, the people whose marginal productive effort is higher. And it is for these people that you want to devise more precise performance measurement techniques, right? So let's say you have a professor at the university who is quite important in the German system, right? So there's teaching, there's research. Each chair costs up to, well, sometimes even more than €1 million per year to run. So we're talking about serious money to support guys like me. So they are important. They do a lot of work. They generate a lot of scientific and pedagogical output and. So they need to be evaluated and incentivized, and they need to be evaluated a lot more precisely, that is with a lower, with a lot lower sigma squared, than people who people whose performance is also important but not that important. For instance, a lot of household activities like cleaning, small repairs, etc. In the University of Konstanz are outsourced, right? So there are external agencies that do that. The University of Konstanz pays money to the contractors, but it spends zero on performance evaluation of these guys. Why? The monitoring intensity principle. The monitoring intensity should be higher for jobs where the marginal product of effort is higher, for jobs that are more pivotal to the organization as compared to the jobs that are less important for the organization. So strong incentives, high precision of performance measurement, more productive, more important occupations, stronger incentives, more precise performance measurement. It takes a lot more effort to evaluate the performance of someone more important and higher up in the organizational hierarchy than line employees. I've seen evaluations at various levels of hierarchy, and they by and large reflect this point. The lower rank workers have less precise performance evaluation tools than more senior ones. Why? We know why. There is a need to incentivize workers differently, but the need to incentivize workers differently has to be taken in the context with the need to measure performance with adequate degree of precision in order to create the required strength of incentives. So if you want higher strength of incentives, you have to measure performance more precisely. Now, let's move on to the next of the four principles of scientific performance evaluation, the informativeness principle. So the informativeness principle, what it says, that performance measure should be informative, yeah. What it says, that you should use every piece of information available to you that is somehow correlated with the agent's effort, right, or the other factors that affect the agent's performance outcome, in order to get as precise as possible a measure of the agent's effort. So, what is informative? What is the notion of informative? Well, there are two meanings to this notion, and we're going to consider both of them. For first, what is an informative performance indicator? An informative performance indicator is an indicator that is correlated with your effort. The second meaning of informativeness is an indicator that is not correlated with your effort, but is correlated with something else that determines the performance indicator based on which you are evaluated. And you're going to use it in order to reduce the noise in the performance indicator that the firm is using to evaluate you. So we're going to look at the two examples. In one example, it's the first meaning of informativeness. namely that we are namely that there is an indicator that is correlated with your effort. So here we are. Here is a very simple linear incentive problem that we have gone through several times in this course. So several references to this in the lecture and the tutorials. We know what the optimal strength of incentives in this setting is. This is the formula that we've derived, and you know it. Okay. Now, notice that this was the result. This was the optimal strength of incentive that is obtained based on the performance measure Z. And that is the only performance measure which is used by the principal in order to devise the incentive contract for the agent. Now, this principal has obviously not attended my lecture on scientific principles of performance evaluation. Because if he or she had attended my lecture on performance evaluation, they would consider taking additional indicators of performance and trying to incorporate these indicators into the design of incentive compensation scheme. As I said, there are many different aspects of performance, and they are informative about the agent's effort to a different extent. And so to the extent that they are informative about the agent effort, they should be incorporated into performance assessment, and they should be reflected in incentive compensation. To illustrate this, consider another indicator. So here's another indicator that is also informative about my effort in the sense that it is caused by my effort and also is affected by some noise. So this is my wage, this is my research productivity, and my wage is higher if my research productivity is higher and lower if my research productivity is lower. And this is my teaching productivity, which is also a function of my effort, right? So why not incorporate this measure of performance into the design of my incentive scheme and to see what happens? So suppose now the principal has reconsidered his decision and decided to be more inclusive and look at more than one measure of performance that is available on my file. And as a result of this, the principal decides to reward me based not only on the Z performance indicator that has been used so far, but also to some extent on this new performance indicator, I, which is also a function of my effort. Okay, now, you are welcome to redo this exercise with this wage schedule and basically go through the same usual steps as before, write down the incentive constraints, participation constraint, plug everything into the principal's profit function and maximize it with respect to the beta Z and beta I, the optimal strength of incentives with respect to the performance indicator Z and I. So after half an hour, maybe, of doing it, you should arrive at these results, at these solutions. So this is the optimal strength of incentives based on the performance measure Z. This is how much I should get based on each unit of the Z performance measure. This is how much I should get for every paper that I publish, right? This is the optimal strength of incentives with respect to the performance measure I. This is how much I should get for an additional point on the student evaluations. Okay? Now, let us look at the anatomy of these quantities, of these results, and see whether they make sense. And of course, they make a lot of sense, as each and every bit of my lecture. notice first that these betas are not equal to each other, right? They're not equal to each other. And they, more importantly, the beta based on Z is not equal to the beta based on Z when Z was the only performance indicator. So it's not that the university is continuing to pay me the same amount based on every piece of research that I produce. The university pays me now a different amount based on the research that I produce, right? So why? Because it optimally uses additional information contained in the other performance indicator I. Now, let's see how, let's see what happens. Now, suppose that this performance indicator I is totally useless, in the sense that it's so lousily measured, in the sense that it's so uninformative about effort, that it's so much subject to random noise, that the precision with which this performance is measured is extremely high, is extremely low. So the sigma squared of this indicator is very large. So let's say in the limit it approaches infinity. Now, if sigma squared epsilon, if the precision of this indicator is super low, right, then taking the limit of this expression when sigma squared epsilon approaches infinity, what you're going to get is you're going to get beta I equals zero in the limit, because you know if this thing is very large, then the denominator is going to be very large and beta I is going to be zero. Now, taking the limit of this expression, you'll have that in the limit, the optimal strength of incentives based on Z approaches to the optimal strength of incentives based only on Z. And why? Because I is so rubbish, is so unreliable, so uninformative, that even if it's available, it's not going to be used. It's not going to be used optimally. So the informativeness principle not only says that you should use all the performance indicators available, it says also, and perhaps more importantly, more cleverly, that you should use performance indicators, you should use the available performance indicators to the extent that they are informative, that they tell you something about the effort of the agent, right? So it's no good using 150,000 performance indicators, even if you have them on file, right? You should use them to the extent that they are informative about the agent's effort. And if they are not informative about the agent's effort, if they are not precise, then you should not use them. Then the optimal strength of incentives with respect to these performance indicators should be zero. Now, let's get back to the notion of informativeness and remember that informativeness exists in two meanings. The first meaning is it being correlated with the effort, which is what we have just considered. The second meaning of informativeness is, you could have performance measures that are totally uncorrelated with effort. Are they useful? They may be useful. They may be useful to the extent that these performance measures are correlated with the noise in performance. So you have the typical story. So you have the main performance measure Z, which is a function of effort. Suppose that there is another measure of performance, I, right, which is not a function of agent's effort at all. So agent's effort does not enter I at all, right? Let's say weather outside. Now, should we use this measure of performance? Well, we may, and we will use it if it is correlated with the noise in the performance measure based on which we calculate incentive pay, right? So, and why should we use a performance measure that has nothing to do with the agent's effort? We should use it and we will use it in order to clear up, in order to kill some of the noise that sits in the performance measure that is influenced by the agent's effort. And why do we want to kill some of the noise in that performance measure? Because remember, the less noisy performance measure we have, the stronger incentives are and the higher effort the agent will put in, right? So that's what the monitoring intensity principle is telling us. So we are interested in reducing this noise in the way that is economically feasible. So let's say that now the principle is using both the Z indicator of performance and also the principle is using the I indicator of performance. So the I is now incorporated into the incentive contract. So it's basically it's beta times Z, which is the traditional traditionally used performance indicator, plus some coefficient, which is the product of beta and the coefficient gamma, on the performance indicator that is, look here, not related to the agent's effort. You'd say, what the hell? Why do you want to do this? Well, stay tuned. Let us calculate the optimal values of the beta and the gamma and see, you know, whether using this additional indicator is going to make things better, is going to increase the profit of the principal. So this is the principal's expected profit based on this new incentive contract which incorporates indicator I. Now you have to pay the risk premium to the agent. This is the risk premium that you have to pay to the agent. It's proportional to the risk aversion, the strength of incentives, and the variance of the wage that the agent is facing. Now, what is the variance of the wage that the agent is facing? Now, this variance is equal to the variance not only of the term eta, which we know is sigma squared, but rather it's equal to the variance of the sum of these guys. Okay? Now, what is the variance of the sum of these guys? Well, it's the variance of eta, which is sigma squared, plus gamma squared, gamma is a parameter, gamma squared times the variance of this new performance indicator I, which is what we are currently using, plus, this is the most important parameter, this is the most important part. If eta and I are correlated with each other, if performance indicator I is correlated with the noise to Z, which is eta, then there is going to be a non-zero third parameter in the variance, which is twice gamma times the covariance between the noise eta and the noise in I. Okay? Now, in the optimum, you want to devise an incentive contract which gives you the strongest incentives, right? Because you're still not in the efficient case, but you want to get as close as possible to it. So how can you devise the strongest incentive possible? The strongest incentive possible you can devise if you minimize the noise. Remember, the noise and the strength of incentives are inversely related. So if you want to maximize the strength of incentives, you have to minimize the noise. How do you minimize the noise? What can you change here in this expression? Sigma squared is given. You're not going to adopt a new performance measurement technology now. The variance of I is given. It's just an indicator, again, which is given to you. The only thing you can change here is gamma. So if you minimize this expression with respect to gamma, just take the first order condition with respect to gamma and solve for it, you'll see that the gamma, the optimal gamma, the optimal value of the coefficient with which performance indicator I enters the incentive contract is equal to minus something that is, it's not exactly equal, but it's minus the correlation between the noise in Z and the noise in I. So if eta and I are correlated with each other, this covariance is going to be large relative to the variance of I, which means that the gamma should be more important in the incentive compensation. If, however, I is totally useless in the sense that it's not correlated with the noise in the performance indicator Z, then this covariance is going to be zero, and we are back, gamma is equal to zero, and we are back to the original performance contract, which is only a function of Z. Now, with gamma equals zero, this term goes away, and we can forget about it as a bad dream. Right. So, but it's not always the case. You can have performance indicators that are correlated with each other because they have the common parameter in their noise term. Let me give you an example. It's a real life example. Consider the year 2009, long time ago. There was a car dealership in Germany, a network of car dealers in various cities, right? So in Frankfurt, the car dealership in Frankfurt sold 40% less cars than was their sales target for the year 2009. 40% less. Question is, should you give the bonus to the Frankfurt guys or not? What do you think? They didn't reach the target. Should you give them bonus nevertheless? Crisis, yes, crisis. Right? Remember, there was a crisis, there was a recession. You probably don't remember it, but yes, there was a crisis. And indeed, the dealerships in other towns sold 60% less than their target. Should you give them a bonus? Should you give the bonus to the Frankfurt guys? Even if they didn't meet the target? Why? Why would this be optimal thing to do? Even if they didn't meet the target. Remember, we are talking about the bonus based on your performance. Your performance is inadequate. Why should you be given a bonus? Because if your contract, if your incentive contract is based only on your performance, so this is how many cars you sell yourself, right? If you don't care about how many cars the other guys are selling, then you are not following the informativeness principle of performance evaluation. You're throwing away information that is potentially useful, and therefore you're not maximizing profit. You're not maximizing profit by doing this way, right? It's not an act of charity. It's not an act of recognition of superior relative effort. No one is charitable. Everybody cares about money. And this was commercially the optimal decision to make. Why? Because this would be an incentive contract based on relative performance evaluation. This contract design would take into account not only how many cars the Frankfurt people sold, but also how many cars the Munich people sold, or Ingolstadt people sold, or Konstanz people sold, whatever, right? The average, sort of. And why would it be the case? Because the shocks to sales, shocks to car sales in Frankfurt, and shocks to car sales in Konstanz are correlated, and very, very profoundly, very tightly correlated, because there was a crisis, and no one was buying cars. Right? So this macroeconomic environment affected car sales to the same extent across the country, across Europe, across the world. Right? So the correlation between the shock to car sales in Frankfurt and the shock to car sales in Konstanz was very, very high, almost one. Of course, there were some idiosyncratic shocks, etc., etc., but the shock was quite profound and affected all car sales, which means... Look here, which means that the optimal incentive scheme for car sales people should not only be based on their own sales of cars, but also, and with a negative sign, on the car sales of the other guys. So if the other guys sold less than their target, they should get a premium for it, the Frankfurt people. Optimally, not as an act of charity. So here's an illustration of incentives based on relative performance, which basically gives you some mathematical structure to the example that we have just discussed. So here's two agents, the same production costs, the same production technology, etc. One is based in Frankfurt, one is based in Konstanz. So this is the output of the Frankfurt agent, this is the output of the Konstanz agent. Epsilon tilde is the effort of the Konstanz guy, so the people in Konstanz always work something like this, that's why it's with a tilde. Now, the shocks to performance, the shock to car sales of the Konstanz person and the Frankfurt person are correlated, and suppose now you want to incorporate, you want to calculate the incentive contract which is based not only on your own sales, but also on the difference between your sales and the sales of the Konstanz guy, right? And the same for Konstanz guy. So the contract for the Konstanz would be based on the sales of in Konstanz and the difference between the sales in Konstanz and the sales in Frankfurt. Now, do it at home. Do it at home. And when you go through the maths, you will get the result that the optimal strength of incentives for your own output is this, and the optimal strength of incentives for the constant guy output, it has nothing to do with your output. You don't know him, right? But his output affects your compensation with this coefficient. So the agent is rewarded not only for how many cars he sells, but also for any excess of own output above that of the other agent. So if you sell more than people in other regions, you should get a premium for it, even if you didn't meet your own sales target. You see this? Now, is this the optimal thing to do? It is the optimal thing to do because, you know, let us calculate the strength of incentives when you do relative performance evaluation. If you calculate the total optimal strength of incentives, if you calculate basically the marginal product of your effort, given the relative performance-based incentive scheme, you will see that the strength of incentives is equal to this parameter, to this expression. And as long as rho is not zero, as long as the shocks to output are correlated, as long as this correlation is not zero, the optimal strength of incentives when you use relative performance information is always going to be larger than the optimal strength of incentives if you only base compensation on your own output. Now remember, you're always interested in designing strong incentives. We will have a lecture which will challenge this view, but so far in mathematical terms, you always want to create as strong incentives as you possibly can, because this is the way for you to maximize the effort of the agent and get it as close as possible to the efficient level. One way to do this is to practice relative performance evaluation, because that gives you stronger incentives. Yes? Yeah. That's right. You're totally right. So this is the list of problems with relative performance evaluation, right? And your point belongs here, exactly, right? So don't do it in teams. Don't do it in teams. Now call Kienbaum Associates, who are CNB consultants in Frankfurt area, and they will give you the price of how much it costs to, you know. It's affordable. Firms use it. You know, firms like a lot of CNB consultants, including Kienbaum. Kienbaum I know relatively better. That's why I'm, you know. So they actually selling these databases of how much money people earn and what their performance targets are. Because what you want to do is you want to benchmark, right? And the benchmarking is a very popular practice of performance evaluation. Look here, I mean, to begin with the very beginning of this lecture, you know, let me boast once again. What is this blue line doing here in my evaluation output? What's it doing there? The blue line is the Durchschnitt der Veranstaltungen Bachelor Grundlagen Winter Semester 14-15. This is the Fachbereich average. What's it doing there? It's a benchmark against which my performance, the red line, is evaluated. Right? So, and you can feel good about it, you can feel bad about it, depending on whether you're on the right or left side of the benchmark. But so here's an example. Here's a practical example of how incentive compensation packages are designed in real firms for real people. And an important part of incentive compensation package is based on benchmarking performance. So you as a manager will get your bonus not only based on how much your department will sell, but also, in part, on the relative sales of your department as compared to the other departments in the benchmark group. Now, creating the benchmark group is very, very difficult. You do need specialist help to do this. Because if you're not using the right benchmark group, what's happening is you reduce the ability of the other performance indicator to extract the noise from the performance indicator that you are currently using, the Z indicator. So you cannot practice very strong incentives based on the benchmark that is poorly defined. If you think your benchmark is correctly defined, but in fact it is poorly defined, you will design and incentives which are stronger than optimal. What this will result is you will expose people to too much risk. They will probably leave, and you will have to deal with the costs of turnover, which will be the topic of one of the lectures later on in the course. The equal compensation principle, we're doing well in terms of time. The equal compensation principle is the next stop on this exciting intellectual journey. What it says, it says that every aspect of the agent's performance should be rewarded in proportion to the value it creates for the principal. So if something is relatively more important, you should offer stronger incentives for this aspect of performance than for the aspect of performance that is relatively less important. Now, this is an interesting story, and it brings us in the world, which is a slightly more realistic world, in which there's more than one dimension of effort. So far, we've been doing the maths and we've been telling stories about effort being only one dimensional. So you could have effort 10, you can have effort 5, you can have effort 25, right? But what is effort 5, 10, 25? I can spend 5 on research, I can spend 0 on teaching, I can spend 3 on admin. What is my total effort, right? Or does my total effort even exist as a construct? So now imagine an environment in which there's more than one dimension of effort. So you have effort in the activity 1, effort in the activity 2, etc., etc. Now, one example that is very frequently given in management textbooks is suppose that you can put in effort into creating quantity of output and you can put in effort into creating quality of output. These are two different efforts, right? So if I want to, my effort in towards creating quantity of my teaching would be to give more courses than I'm currently giving with the same level of preparation. That will be the effort directed at quantity. The effort directed at quality would be to read more books and create better slides, generate more content, more interesting questions, make myself available more for more hours for students of the same course. As you can see, there's two different dimensions of effort. Now, let's see what happens. These two different dimensions of effort should be rewarded separately and in proportion to the benefit that they create for the principal. If not, then what was going to happen, the agent will concentrate on only one aspect of effort, for example, quantity, totally forgetting about quality, and that, of course, is not good for the principal. Now, let's see how it works mathematically. Suppose now there are two dimensions of your effort. You can put effort E1 into activity 1. You can put effort E2 into the activity 2. And these two activities generate two different performance measures. Right? So you see the difference with this. Notice the difference between this setting and the informativeness principle. In the informativeness principle, effort was unidimensional. There was no E1, E2. But there were several performance indicators, each of which were functions of the same E. Right now, you have different performance indicators. Right now, you have different performance indicators, which are functions of different efforts and are not correlated with each other. Right? That's the difference. Now, let's write down the contract which rewards your output on activity, which rewards your output on activity 1 and also rewards your output on activity 2. This is the certainty equivalent of the wage. You know, I took care of the, so this is your expected wage and this is the risk premium that you should get. So that's already the certainty equivalent. Now, let's see what effort of level the agent will decide to put in into which activity given the incentive parameters beta 1 and beta 2. Differentiate this expression with respect to E1 and E2 to determine the optimal effort levels, and you will see that the two first order conditions, the two first order conditions for the two different effort levels are in fact one first order condition. Look here. So the marginal cost of total effort should be equal to the strength of incentives given for activity one, and it also should be equal to the strength of incentives given to the activity two. So if you want the agent to carry out both activities, if you want the agent to do quantity and quality rather than quantity alone, you have to reward quantity and quality to the same extent, right? So beta 1 should be equal to beta 2. Now, what's the big deal, you might ask? What are the implications? What are we learning for management practices from this? A lot. Because remember, you know, this trivial mathematical result is at the very start of the optimal incentive design process, right? So the principal then has to plug it in into the participation constraint and then maximize the profit with respect to beta 1 and beta 2. That's where the problem actually is, because the optimal beta 1 as well as the optimal beta 2 are going to be functions of the noise. They're going to be functions of the noise on these two performance measures. So beta 1 is going to be a function of the noise of eta 1. Beta 2 is going to be a function of the noise of beta 2. But the requirement that they should be equal for the agent to put in optimal effort level, this requirement really screws things up. It really limits the choice of optimal incentive scheme. Imagine, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to do so. Imagine that activity one, performance indicator one, Z1, is measured more precisely than performance indicator 2. So if Z1 is quantity you can measure fairly precisely. You can always calculate how much physical output the agent has produced. So the noise on eta 1 is going to be small. Okay. Now, Z2 is quality. Quality is also possible to measure, but not as well, right? How do you measure quality? There's always a noise component to the quality measure, right? It could be subjective. If you want to measure quality objectively, you'd have to destroy some of the output. You'd have to, you know, see how well it works, etc. You have to invest a lot more time to measure quality than quantity. Therefore, the monitoring intensity principle would dictate that the optimal precision with which you measure quality should be less than the optimal precision with which you measure quantity, simply because quality is harder to measure. But then, if the noise of activity 2 is large, the sigma squared is large, not only are you going to offer low strength of incentives for that activity, for quality, but because of this requirement, you will also have to offer low strength of incentives for quantity. Now, one of the mistakes that firms do is they say, okay, we're going to offer strong incentives for something that we can measure precisely, and we're going to offer weak incentives for something that we can't measure precisely. That's a mistake, right? Why is it a mistake? Because if you offer higher incentive for quantity and lower incentive for quality, this condition is not going to hold. You're going to have a corner solution in which E1 is going to, in which E2 is going to be zero, so you will not care about quality at all. You will direct your entire effort, subject to your participation constraint, into producing quantity. So you will produce lots and lots of output, but the quality of it will not be the optimal. Why not? Because you're not incentivized for quality. Now, if you want to be incentivized for quality and quantity, you have to offer equal strengths of incentives for the two. Unfortunately, you're going to lose a lot of efficiency doing so. Why? Because quality is hard to measure, and therefore you can't offer strong incentives for quality. Unless you spend lots of money measuring quality, which is another strategy, but it's going to cost you. Right? Clear? Understand? Okay. Now, let's move on to the alignment principle. This is going to be This is going to be the last of the topics that we will consider in the lecture today. What is the alignment principle? Now, the effort now is multidimensional. What it means? What it means is that the performance indicator, the desired result for the firm is a function of different dimensions of effort that the agent puts in. So let's go back to the example of long-term financial viability that I gave in the beginning of this lecture. So this is long-term financial viability. This is what every firm wants to have. And it's a function of the employee's effort towards sales. Yes, you need to generate sales to be financially viable, right? But there's a second dimension of effort. Let's call it customer service or quality, right? So you also have to have good customer service standards and high quality standards, because if not, then customers will not be loyal to you and they will switch to another producer. So in the long run, you are facing the risk of your customers deserting you, this kind of thing, right? But you don't know precisely, you don't observe this long-term financial viability precisely. You get accounting reports, you get marketing reports, you try to make sense of how well your firm is doing with respect to what you really want to achieve, but you fundamentally you don't observe the why. What you do observe instead is some accounting performance measure, P. And this accounting performance measure is also a function of the different dimensions of the agent's effort. But the coefficients with which the different dimensions of agent's effort enter into this function may be different from the original ones. So customer service may be quite important. So delta 2 for customer service may be quite important for long-term financial viability. But what you do have before your eyes is short-term accounting reports, basically which tell you how much you've sold today. Now, customer service is not going to be very important for sales today. So therefore, this coefficient, gamma 2, is not going to be proportional to delta 2. It's not going to be equal to delta 2. So long-term financial viability is affected by sales, by the quantity that you produce. But what is even more affected by the quantity that you produce is your today's accounting reports, right? So the lack of proportionality between the coefficients with which the same dimensions of effort enter the true performance indicator and the proxy performance indicator create the so-called misalignment problem. So the alignment principle says that the extent to which different dimensions of performance affect the observed performance outcome should be proportional or aligned with the coefficients with which the same dimensions of effort affect the desired outcome. Now, let's see how it works. Because the principal does not observe what he really wants to have, he uses some accounting measure of performance, and he designs an incentive contract to the agent based on the accounting measure of performance that he observes. Makes sense, right? You have to measure performance if you want to practice incentives. Now, the costs of effort are quadratic, as before. This is the certainty equivalent of the agent's utility. The agent maximizes the utility with respect to effort 1 and effort 2. Given the incentive parameter, given the strength of incentive beta. Now, as homework, as practice for preparing the exam, you're strongly encouraged to derive the optimal strength of incentives given this setting. And once you're done with your derivations, you should get this answer. This is the answer for the optimal strength of incentives. Now, given this optimal strength of incentives, you can calculate the expected profit of the principal and use this in order to explore the efficiency implications of misalignment between observed and desired performance outcomes. Now, what is the first best? What is the highest possible profit that you could potentially achieve, right? Suppose you have all the information in the world, the effort is perfectly observed, the outcome that you want to achieve is also perfectly observed. So what is the best, highest value of the profit that you can achieve? Well, it's the difference between the outcome that you want to achieve and the costs of effort that it takes to achieve this outcome. So far we ignore, we rightly ignore risk considerations because in the first best, the effort is observed. So this is the problem in terms of effort rather than in terms of performance indicators. Now, maximizing this profit with respect to the effort levels, you get the optimal effort levels, and when you substitute them back into this profit, you'll get that the first best level of profit is equal to this. Now, let us compare the first best profit with the second best profit level, which is achieved given the optimal strength of incentives that the principal derives based on the imperfect measure of performance P. Just take the difference between the first best and the second best. This will be, by definition, the efficiency loss. Now, after some tinkering with the algebra, you get the following elegant representation of this efficiency loss. What's so elegant in it? Well, it tells you that, well, this is how much money you basically lose. This is how much money you lose as a firm for not being able to observe effort and not being able to observe the right performance outcome that you are interested in. So there are two parts to this efficiency loss. One is familiar, the risk premium. You lose some efficiency because the agent is risk averse. Had the agent been risk neutral, so R is zero, this term would go away. Now, are you back in the full efficiency case, even if the agent is risk neutral? Unfortunately not, because there is this second component in the efficiency loss. And this is the component which is due to the misalignment, due to the lack of proportionality between the coefficients gamma 1 and gamma 2 that shape the observed performance outcome as a function of effort, and the coefficients delta 1 and delta 2 that shape the desired performance outcome as a function of effort, right? So if the same level of effort, if quantity and quality affect today's profit in a way that is different from the way in which they affect long-term profit, then you have this misalignment problem. And this term is strictly positive, it's above zero, so you're always going to experience efficiency loss if you're using a proxy for performance which does not have the alignment property. Now, the question is, suppose you are in the risk-neutral world, so let's not worry about risk considerations. The question for us is, how can we reduce the misalignment? What should we do to bring this guy to zero? Right? What is the condition that gammas and deltas must satisfy in order for the loss from misalignment to be reduced to zero? Well, that's very easy. You just have to solve this equation, delta 1 times gamma 2 minus delta 2 times gamma 1 equals zero. And as a result, you're going to get, so let's divide everything by delta 2 times gamma 2. You get delta 1 over delta 2 equals gamma 1 divided by gamma 2. Am I right? Yes. Right? So if you have this result, if you have the proportionality between the weights in the real in the desired performance outcome and the weights on the same activities in the observed performance outcome, then this misalignment term is going to go to zero. So you will not have the misalignment problem. Whenever you have this misalignment, whenever there is no proportionality between the way in which quantity and quality enter long-term and short-term profits, you're always going to have an efficiency loss. Why? Because the agent will exploit you. The agent will exploit you. The agent will try to maximize effort along the dimension that is rewarded relatively more generously, given the weights gamma, even though this distribution of effort is not optimal for the long-term interests of the principal. The agents don't care about long-term interests of the principal. The principal may want to try to make agents care about their long-term interests by specifying evaluation, communicating the values so that the agents will say, oh yes, that's what we want. We want quality, we want customer service. But then, excuse me, mister, do you give me any bonus for quality or customer service? As far as I can see, you only reward my sales. So I will concentrate on generating sales as hell, earning high bonuses, then doing a cheerio to you and leaving you with dissatisfied customers after a few years' time. So in order to avoid this outcome, the performance indicator that firms use must have coefficients on the individual output on the individual effort levels of the agent that are proportional to what you want to achieve. So if you prioritize quality, if quality is important for you in the long run, you have to make sure that you reward quality sufficiently highly and use the adequate weight on quality in the short run observed performance outcome based on which you pay incentives to your agents. That basically is the story. Now, what makes a good performance measure? A good performance measure is the one that satisfies the alignment principle. Right? So a good performance measure must also satisfy the informativeness principle. So this is just a summary, if you like. Informativeness principle says that you should use every bit of information that is relevant to calculate the agent's, to estimate the agent's effort or to isolate the noise to agent's effort in the performance measure that you use. So you should use indicators that are correlated with the agent's effort or indicators whose noise terms are correlated with each other. But you should not take this idea too far, because if you have a high correlation between something that you want, the desired outcome Y, and the accounting artifact of it P, this correlation itself is not enough to for P to be a good performance measure. To illustrate this, you know, this correlation could be because both the long-term desired outcome and the short-term accounting measure will share a powerful noise term to them, right? They will be correlated through the noise term, but they are not going to be correlated through the effort levels that generate them. Okay? So, benchmarking, you have to use relative performance evaluation whenever possible, and benchmarking is very important. It's not always easy to do relative performance evaluation for a variety of reasons that we've outlined in this lecture, thanks to one of the students for providing additional input in there. There is a trade-off between how strong incentives you want to have and how precisely you have to measure performance to support these strong incentives. The stronger incentives you want to have, the more precise you have to measure performance. Now, measuring performance is expensive, so you should not always measure performance as precisely as possible. Rather, you should compare the benefits from better performance measurement in terms of stronger incentives with the costs of performance measurement in terms of, yes, the costs of performance measurement. That's basically it for today. Next week we're going to look at the practical implementations of scientific principles of performance measurement. For now, thanks for your attention. See you next week.